Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, all right, welcome to the program. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're live and direct for the next 2 hours. Thank you so much for joining us. We've got a powerful program lined up for you today. Very special segment, and what great timing. We're going to be welcoming onto the program in a few minutes, live from Moscow, Arno Devole. He's a journalist. He's a human rights activist, human rights lawyer. He's also author of the brand new book, Foreign Entanglements, hot off the press. It's hot, literally hot off the press. Just came out 48 hours ago. It's already sold out on Amazon in the United States. So I think their publisher is going to have to re-up the stock. The demand is high. This is an incredible book, and we're going to get first crack at Arno. This is one of the first interviews he's given since the book has been on release. So we're really pleased he's going to join us in just a couple of minutes. In the second hour, we're going to be joined by Basil Valentine, who's going to be piping in from the United Kingdom for World Headlines. Basil's also got a few things to share with us. We're always looking forward to our conversations with TNT's political editor, Basil Valentine. So that's going to be something. I think straight off the bat, we have to announce, a sad announcement. In mixed emotions for some people, O.J. Simpson, the football legend, also who became infamous in the 90s for the murder trial of Nicole Brown Simpson. O.J. Simpson has passed away at the age of 76, apparently died of cancer. So very sad indeed. Don't have a lot of details on this, but there was a post from the family on his X account or their X account. He served 9 years of a 33-year sentence for kidnapping and armed robbery unconnected to the death of his ex-wife before he was released in October 2017 from the detention center in Reno. Since then, he's been kind of a journeyman around the country, moving around between Florida, Nevada, California, Arizona. OJ sightings have been frequent and many over the years. He never regained his stature, though, as a very successful actor and, of course, a legend in the NFL with the Buffalo Bills. O.J. Simpson's career, absolutely legendary on the sporting side, became a real personality doing Hertz car rental ads, running through airports. That was something O.J. became famous for. And then this unfortunate incident happened in 1994. So he was not found guilty. Double murder charges, however, shattered his reputation as a minimal and friendly face, advertising friendly face. Remember, before that, nobody, in terms of an ex-athlete, had forged a career outside of sports like O.J. Simpson had. And who knows where that would have taken him had his life taken another turn. Maybe he would have been in politics. Maybe he would have run for governor of California instead of Arnold Schwarzenegger at the late 90s, early 2000s era. So interesting story. I mean, they'll be talking about this. The only downside of this, of course, is that CNN and all the networks are going to be running retrospectives of O.J. Simpson for the next 48 hours and the panels assembled. You have to understand something, how crucial O.J. Simpson was, not just for the careers of so many people. The O.J. Simpson trial catapulted the careers of so many lawyers and TV talking heads. I mean, the list is literally endless. This is one of the first televised, high-profile, long-running criminal trials in world history. I remember being halfway across the world, and they're showing the O.J. trial in a local pub in London. Everyone's fixated on this drama. But if you think about, Robert Kardashian, F. Lee Bailey, Alan Dershowitz, Greta Van Susteren, all of these lawyers, there's too many to even mention, but everybody seemed to be a part of the O.J. Simpson defense team. Then you had the prosecutors as well. More or less all these people basically relaunched a career into television presenting, cable news, celebrity attorneys, you name it. Everybody made bank out of the O.J. Simpson trial, probably except O.J. himself. So isn't that something? Only in America, as Don King would say, only in America. So you can thank OJ, you guys, for your great careers, but they rarely do, but they should. They should. So on to other news. Again, we're going to connect Arnaud Devillet, author of Foreign Entanglements. The book is out already on Amazon in the U.S. and Barnes & Noble as well. And who knows, by the end of the month, other fine booksellers, hopefully. We'll talk to him about this. The timing of it's uncanny. We'll talk about that. The link between the Central Intelligence Agency and the terrorist attacks in Moscow, which is being talked about by all the top analysts and pundits right now, after the evidence was put forth by the Special Investigative Commission in Moscow regarding the Crocus City Hall terrorist attacks, which happened just a couple of weeks ago. I myself was in Moscow at the time of these terror attacks, and I did file a report at the time for RT International, which turned out to be, you know, pretty accurate, actually. That was just hours or, you know, 24 hours after the attack. So we'll talk about that and more. And how does this trace back to Biden and Burisma? That's Hunter Biden's gas company. That's one of the big cash cows of the Biden crime syndicate, or let's just say the Biden enterprise overseas in China, in Ukraine, wherever else Hunter was spinning up deals while he was sitting across the table with the CIA. Imagine. Dad has really set up his son for success. I think few can argue that. Now, this is an interesting story here, which is just broken, actually, literally within the last hour. Synagogue attack thwarted in Moscow. The FSB broken up or, quote, neutralized a terrorist suspect and responded with armed resistance during detention, a terrorist attacking, targeting a mosque, a synagogue in Moscow has been prevented, according to the Russian FSB. They made the announcement just a couple of hours ago. The suspect was shot and killed during a standoff with FSB agents. And Russian media has aired a statement from the agency, and they're confirming that they believe this was a terrorist attack planned against a synagogue. Now, where is this coming from? Where is this coming from? We've seen some dubious supposed terrorist attacks against synagogue-type targets in the United States. And after the fact, some interesting facts and revelations have been aired as to, you know, who was actually behind it, what was the intention. In some cases, these were staged. I don't want to go any further into that, but you can look those up for yourself. In the United States, there have been many. And you can file those under the banner of fake hate crimes. Okay, so now we're not saying that this is the case here. However, if you wanted to push a global narrative that, let's say, anti-Semitism is on the rise in Russia, for instance, or Europe, and if you were a certain intelligence agency from a certain country, this might be one way by setting up an operation like this or paying some stooge or some lackey to basically go shoot up something or plant a bomb or whatnot, which looks like was the case at Crocus City Hall just a couple of weeks ago in Moscow, then you do have an equation there that is not unfamiliar to the world of tradecraft. I'm talking about spies, lies, and other useful idiots. This is unfortunately the litany of events like this right across Europe. I talked about Operation Gladio in the wake of the Crocus City Hall attacks, and Gladio as a strategy of tension, either to create ethnic tension within a country, to create demographic tension, political tension, or geopolitical tension. So I'm looking at this event and looking at who might be behind it, what the motivation might be, and I'm always factoring in the Gladio element. I'm just saying it's possible. And of course, we're not pointing any fingers at any specific foreign countries here, but there are a few in North America and one in the Middle East that is active on all of these fronts, and very active indeed. And it's well-funded, well-financed. And it also could be done through Ukraine, as we have discovered recently. Again, we'll talk to our next guest about that possibility. But it all kind of comes together, doesn't it, when you start to dig in and look at history and contextualize these things, which is something we try to do on this program. We're going to connect as well at the top of the second hour, hopefully, with Basil Valentine, a political editor for TNT. We're going to talk about some of the breaking stories in the Middle East. Right now, let's take a break with the network. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We'll be right back.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
It's time to switch on
today's news talk radio.
Very entertaining.
Yeah! TNT.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this live broadcast. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We're live and direct for the next 2 hours. And as we said before the break, we're going to be talking about a very serious subject. Not only that, there's a new book out. And this new book, I've actually got a copy of it right here, Foreign Entanglements, which is Ukraine, Biden, and the Fractured American Political Consensus. The author is Arno Devole, and we happen to have him on the line right now, joining us live from Moscow. Arno, how are you?
Hello, Patrick. I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Arno, it's the book is out. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other fine, hopefully more fine booksellers later on in the next few weeks and months. Fantastic book. Full disclosure, I was privy to an advanced manuscript of this book. And so if you look on the back cover, I did write a very short review on this, and it is fantastic. Now, we've been on this topic, and as our listeners and viewers are fully aware, we've had other guests on and talking about this, the Dercash tapes, Simona Maggianti, the Italian-American journalist. She's been on the program as well after the release of the Dercash interview. And Arno, I have to say, and I'll say it again, Arno, this is an incredibly detailed and well-researched book. Just tell us the story behind this. What gave you the inspiration to write this? And it's a difficult topic, Arno, because so many people have done reporting on this, but yet you've managed to find things that nobody else has found. Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, to be sure, I was traveling in the Donbass during the referendum back in 2022. And I met a few people locally, Ukrainians. Back then, they were Ukrainians. As you know, they are now a new subject of the Russian Federation. And basically, some of the things that are related in my book were somehow alluded to by people who exercised some responsibility there. And so initially, I didn't really pay much attention to it, bent on making sure that the referendum was being carried out in a transparent way. And later on, I somehow decided to look into this. I was somewhat aware of the, as you mentioned, the Dercash tapes, but nothing more than that, until I started looking into the nitty-gritty of the tapes, per se, and the transcript of what was being allegedly said between, at the time, Vice President Biden and former Ukrainian President Poroshenko. And it just basically, it was kind of a thread that I kept on pulling on, and it kept on coming. And I just decided that it was interesting in as far as the geopolitical situation is concerned. And I was basically brought to the conclusion that the only way Ukraine might be such a curtain, you know, for the U.S. deep state to use, using, to be sure, proxies, you know, including some of the senior figures that we will mention. I realized that there was a complete external control over that country, all the way down to which kind of laws were to be adopted by the Ukrainian Rada, how those laws were then put into effect to essentially outsource the state-owned company, the juiciest morsels of the Ukrainian economy, and turn it into essentially the playground for Western individuals. And basically, as you said, it's interesting that my book is coming out in the wake not only of the Crocus City Hall attacks, but immediately or almost simultaneously as the Russian Federation Investigative Committee has come up with indications, if not conclusion, that the financier behind those attacks were inter alias the infamous Burisma state and oil company, Ukrainian state and oil company, Burisma, which has been obviously mentioned repeatedly during the congressional hearings, bearing on whether or not now President Biden ought to be impeached. And so it is interesting to somehow put the whole picture together. Sure, it is about corruption. It is about embezzlement of U.S. taxpayers' money. It is about external management of a foreign country. But it is first and foremost about geopolitical issues and how to essentially affect Europe being completely cut off from a cheap source of energy, and thus removing them as economic competitor for the United States.
It's not just that, Arno. It's the real juicy part is to execute that strategy that you have just described. There was a whole queue of people getting rich off the opportunities that Ukraine afforded, especially U.S. connected, either officials, politicians, in the case of Hunter Biden, literally the son of then Vice President Joe Biden. All these people were well positioned, including Joe Biden himself, to profit handsomely from some of the, let's say, enterprises on offer, which are kind of, I look at it like this, Arno, you're describing a geopolitical hit job. And then there's the side hustles. And there's a lot of side hustles here. So everybody seemed to be using Ukraine as their own sort of personal ATM machine for money laundering, embezzlement, washing U.S. funds coming into the country and then exiting, taking money out of the Ukrainian state budget, laundering it through all these different shell companies. You talk about all this stuff. You've got receipts in here, Arno. It's so well documented. And you've got actors like Amos Hochstein, Biden's personal advisor, who's right now in Israel, working as a go-between with the Netanyahu government. He's one of the main protagonists in here. Tell us about some of these connections.
Sure. So Amos Hochstein, for our listeners, is someone well known to the scheme of bearing on gas business, essentially. He was recently the special envoy in Israel and Lebanon, entrusted with trying to solve the issue bearing on the offshore gas block number nine, off the coast of Lebanon. We had a dispute bearing on maritime boundaries. And obviously, all those contracts were signed with those usual suspects, you know, I would say the BP oil and Chevron and all that. But until this was resolved, you know, those oil fields could not be exploited. And so Austin was on point, basically, in trying to work out some kind of agreement which would allow those oil fields, the gas field, offshore gas field, to be essentially exploited. But Austin was, as you mentioned, involved in Ukraine as the, I would say, the overseer of what has been referred as the NAFTOGAS scheme.
This is known as the reverse gas scandal.
The reverse gas scheme, indeed. And reverse gas, for our listener, basically, it's a pretty simple situation. In the context of a taking over of Ukraine, the idea is to basically use some of the Russian gas, which still comes into Ukraine during all that time. We will recall that one of the leitmotif was always that Ukraine was late on its bills. And so basically, that's the idea. Ukraine was receiving Russian gas. The itinerary of the pipeline was designed in such a way that it had to leave the country, go to a third-party country, and re-enter Ukraine. And so the idea, and this was basically discussed during the recording, the leaked recordings, we'll discuss the circumstances leading to the leaking of those tapes later on. That's an interesting aspect also. Led to basically the Vice President Biden pushing for an increase in the Ukrainian consumer basically a bill. 75% was estimated to be the proper rate of increase. And Poroshenko went above the call of duty and proudly proclaimed that he had managed to actually double the tariff, the bills of the poor Ukrainian consumer. So this whole scheme essentially ended up netting about $1.5 billion, which we can only hope, imagine, was then distributed to all kind of operators. Some of them were actually local people working with, one of them was working at the time with the Ukrainian oligarch Akhmetov. So he had experience in those kind of things. He had set up subsidiaries in Switzerland and all, tasked with basically doing this kind of reverse gas business as well. So he had experience in doing that. But this netted a sizable amount of money, to be sure. But made the poor Ukrainian consumers, even poorer for that matter. So this is but one of the schemes that went on in Ukraine between 2014 in the wake of the Maidan coup, all the way to, I would say, about 2020, 2021. A lot of people started feeling that, the heat was bearing down their neck and they basically evaporated. But the deed was done and the loot was substantial. And this brings us to Burisma, because Burisma as a oil and gas company managed to, was already kind of a player prior to the Maidan coup. And its owner, its CEO, Mykolas Shosetsky, happened to, somewhat take a few liberties with, money flows, as it were, keeping some of it for himself, putting it somewhere on his personal account, commingling the funds, in other words, all the while serving as what we would say in the West is environmental minister for the then Yanukovych administration. And so he basically brought attention to then General Prosecutor Viktor Shokin, which we have heard time and time again in the context of then Vice President Biden infamous confession at the Council of Foreign Relations meeting, when he basically flatly stated that he had given an ultimatum to Poroshenko, in exchange for the $1 billion, lifeline, so to speak, he would ask that Shokin be removed. Shokin, who, interestingly enough, was then later on smeared as someone who was corrupt, when in fact he was probably one of the few individuals in Ukraine doing his job, too well. And so basically,
that was a talking point. That was a talking point, Arno, that was just being passed around like a memo everywhere you turned. Oh, Shokin's corrupt. No, don't listen to Shokin. Shokin's corrupt. Biden's saying this corrupt prosecutor, Shokin's corrupt. Literally, they repeated this for like 2 or 3 years after the fact. There was this character assassination agenda to basically smear Viktor Shokin. And nobody could say why he was corrupt. It was just Shokin's corrupt. Was this to protect Joe Biden?
Well, to protect Joe Biden and to protect also what Burisma ended up becoming, because magically, as you would have it, in the wake of Hunter Biden joining and Devon Archer as such joining Burisma, a PR operation was put into place, which led to the complete exoneration by early 2016 of Slushetsky, the unfreezing of the $50 million plus dollars that he had stashed in different accounts in the West, including in the UK. And he's back in Ukraine in early 2016. And by that time, the company acquires new licenses to exploit gas, as it were, in the Donbass area. And so this whole thing is connected in a way that is all too convenient, especially when you take into consideration that, and this is almost a red earring, because Hunter, everybody is focusing on Hunter, but we had Hunter to joining the board. We had the former Polish president, Kaczynski, who was also instrumental in getting Slushetsky, then the Burisma CEO, to should I say expand his Wolodex and get new Western friends and rehabilitate itself in the eyes of the new masters of Ukraine. But we also had, interestingly enough, an individual by the name of Kofor Black. Mm. Kofor Black was in charge of the counterterrorism unit at the Central Intelligence Agency. He was rumored to have retired back about 20 years ago or so, I'd say 2005, 2008, at the time when Porter Goss was the director of the agency. But next thing you know, he's sitting on the board. So what kind of experience does, sure, Hunter Biden has in oil and gas business? That's a legitimate question. But, you know, more importantly, more to the point, what would an ex-senior tradecraft CIA operative have in this business? And you know, there's not much being mentioned about him. That is until Mike Pence kind of basically re-centered the debate on what Kofor Black might have been up to in Ukraine under the cover of being a board member of Burisma. And this brings us exactly in the current situation, which is basically that the Russian Federation is now at the highest official level stating that Burisma was a financier of terrorist attack in and outside of Ukraine. And so this actually fits perfectly with what appears to be the new strategy from the Ukrainian regime, which is a departure from conventional warfare, which has gone really sour by now, as you know, our listeners might have gathered. What with the much vaunted counteroffensive, to reorient and reprogram itself along the lines of exporting terrorism, hence the attacks on the Crocus City Hall, and maybe more to come if we go by what Victoria Nuland ominously referred to on the way out from the State Department.
No, we're going to go to break real quickly here. I'm with Arno Develle, author of Foreign Entanglements, also human rights lawyer. We're talking about the new book, Foreign Entanglements, and how this traces back to the Biden administration. All this and more coming up. We'll be back in a few minutes.
As a combat wounded veteran, I know how hard it is to come home and build a meaningful life. When I was in Iraq, our vehicle was hit. A rocket-propelled grenade exploded right under my seat. Traumatic brain injury, a a fractured pelvis, severe burns. They didn't think I was gonna make it. I had to learn to walk again and live with the scars, both visible and invisible.
DAV helps veterans like LaToya get the benefits they've earned. They help more than a million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
With DAV on my side, I was able to pursue my dreams. If my story can touch a heart, it can change a life. My victory is overcoming my wounds so I can help other veterans.
LaToya Lucas, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
Even the thought of dementia can feel scary. It's why we put off getting help, even though we've noticed changes in our thinking or memory. But an early diagnosis can change everything, giving you medical help and a support system around you to help you live better. Start with Dementia Australia's online checklist. Because the sooner you know, the more you can do.
Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. We're still in the first hour of this live broadcast. I'm here with the author of the new book, Foreign Entanglements, Arno Develays, joining us on the line right now, live from Moscow. Foreign Entanglements is the book, ladies and gentlemen, and you definitely want to pick this up. I'm just saying it is a great resource right now. I mean, few people have managed to put all of the evidence together up to a certain point recently in the timeline that really provides, I think, I can only describe this really as a damning indictment of all of the U.S. grifters who had their hands in the cookie jar in Ukraine, but also on the Ukrainian side. It just sort of documents the corruption there. And you're talking about Burisma and the recent revelations of the financing of terrorism, and some of these companies were used to wash money for black ops. That certainly explains why somebody like Kofor Black would end up on the Burisma board. And also that they used the BCCI, the infamous BCCI bank, to do this very thing for years and decades, in fact, in Central America, and running dirty wars right the way around the world. And it requires, Freddie Ponton, who was on the show yesterday, explained why this is necessary. You need shell companies and banks that the CIA can do business with to finance black ops and to do sort of nefarious things around the world. So that's what we talked about yesterday on the program. And Arno is kind of alluding to this right now. Arno, the other person, and I want to talk about that, this subject of the connection with terrorism, because it's recent. Arno, the timing of these revelations with Burisma and the Russian investigation, and then your book coming out this week, is kind of uncanny. I mean, you probably were wondering, your publishers must have an incredible PR machine, or you're just really lucky. I think probably the latter, Arno, but the timing certainly is excellent, and it kind of like explains in this book how these things are able to happen. So pretty amazing timing. I mean, you must have been shocked this week to see those revelations come out and go global at the very time your book's coming out.
Mishu, it's kind of spooky, but it is what it is. And basically, you know, to the extent the book somewhat sheds a light on the background leading up to this situation we're in, you know, yes, it's a perfect fit, one would say. But it's interesting because it all takes place also in a very contested U.S. presidential election. And we have this kind of lawfare campaign being waged against the main opponent to the incumbent president, which happens to be, appearing front and center in this whole saga. And so you get the feeling that whereas 2016, and I talk about this in my book as well, was an attempt early on in the election campaign season to take out or at least to impede the then candidate Trump presidential campaign. And it all starts again in Ukraine. This is the interesting thing, again, is that Ukraine is a recurring theme the last 8 years as a background to, you know, U.S. presidential politics. And at the time, Trump is not even a threat. He's just this kind of flamboyant real estate tycoon who decides to throw his hat into the ring. And next thing you know, he's beating out 15 rivals within the Republican Party. And this is now becoming increasingly real and credible that he might just, you know, be elected.
And yeah, because you're right. No one took him seriously, Arno, until Super Tuesday, until after the Super Tuesday primaries of 2016. So, I mean, you're absolutely correct. He wasn't regarded as he was regarded as a potential threat going into the new year, but not really a serious threat till after Super Tuesday. But you're saying by then the machine was already in gear to damage him and all of his associates. And it looks like from your book that what you're talking about is the targeting and kind of public assassination of Paul Manafort, who was the head of Trump's campaign at the time. That all was hatched in Ukraine.
Yes, indeed. I mean, to be sure, Paul Manafort had been working in Ukraine under the Yanukovych administration. And when he was tapped to become the director of the Trump campaign, with basically his candidate doing very well, beating out those rival in the Republican Party, and increasingly looking like a serious threat to the powers that be, who, let's not forget, had deeply involved themselves by then, when basically summer, September 2016. By then, the external management of Ukraine is 2.5 years old. And so we can only speculate that the Uniparty or the deep state the people who are basically within the political arena associated with this kind of permanent Washington establishment are seeing this kind of individual just coming out of nowhere, and everybody's starting thinking, if this guy remotely gets a chance to take a look or be informed or somehow meddle with what we're doing there, the whole geopolitical ploy is falling apart, not to mention the uncovering of dirt on senior Democratic officials. And so we have to, basically do everything we can starting right now. And we're at the time, we're in July 2016, to prevent this from happening. And interestingly enough, it's this passion in going after Trump is what somehow should have raised alarm. I mean, if he was just a corruptible man or a corruptible politician, someone who can bring in and brief on certain things, there's no reason to assume he would not play ball after all, right, at the time. But somehow they decided to basically give him the treatment of someone who's kind of like a peasant trying to invite himself at the table of the Lords. And so that had the direct effect in basically getting Trump to, Trump was after all coached by and trained and brought up by no other than Roy Cohn. And Roy Cohn was not known as someone who basically took, blows lying down. He gave back as much as he received. And so that was a major miscalculation. But to come back to Manafort, yeah, to be sure, it all started then. And it started, interestingly enough, using the Ukrainian Secret Service. Actually, let me rectify this. Someone who at some point had been a senior official of that agency, but for whatever reason was let go to be demoted as a mere, not advisor, but I would say a trainer, a professor of state spycraft. And next thing you know, the guy's name is General Trebek. It's an interesting figure because next thing you know, and this is someone who knows the law, right? But he somehow happens to stumble on what became known as the Black Ledger, the Black Book, copies of it, to be sure. And those were left on the stairwell of his apartment building, at his domicile. And so he basically alleged that, someone had come and dropped that off, for him. And he somehow decided to, rather than take it to the proper authorities, he went on a media who happened to be financed by George Soros, Zerkali Nedieli. And only then afterward does he go to the SBU. And so the problem at the time is that on the line where Manafort's name is added to figure, there is no signature. There are obviously other names with amounts received and their signatures, but on Manafort line, there is no signature. It's just some kind of a scintilla of evidence, but nothing hardcore. And to make matters worse, the Ukrainian criminal code procedure basically calls for extra independent evidence to corroborate any kind of whistleblower coming out with the ledger, as it were, the black book. But coming up with a black book on its own without any kind of independent corroborating evidence was not going to cut it. So this ended up essentially going nowhere, legally speaking, and basically leading the Ukrainian regime to say that they would not prosecute Manafort. Why? Because he was an American, as if that made any difference in any other countries on any other type of crimes. But this was important in such a way that it allowed for the media campaign, the smear campaign, to do its effect, do its work, and force Manafort to essentially resign from the Trump campaign. And so we can assume that the calculation was that, you know, by beheading the Trump campaign of its mastermind, its major coordinator, the campaign would then flounder. But that's not what happened, as we know now. And this instead led the way to, you know, pave the way for the narrative that would then plague the Trump administration all the way to May 2019, when the Mueller report was finally made public and there was no collusion. You know, the Russiagate, Trump being this Manchurian candidate. And so it became, to be sure, paramount to link Trump or to characterize his miraculous election, this surprise election against the establishment's candidate, as somehow of a Russian operation. And everything was then, everyone would recall, you know, done to basically prevent him from doing any kind of substantial work. Maybe, you know, allowing him to do a few things on the domestic front, but as far as his foreign policy was concerned, he was basically prevented from doing anything, especially putting his nose into Ukraine. That is all the way until we're in 2019. And at the time, Trump is hearing some kind of rumors that there's a lot going on in Ukraine. And as we know, with the 2020 election, re-election campaign coming, he gets the idea to send his trusted legal advisor, Rudolph Giuliani, America's mayor, you know, someone who cannot be suspected of working for anybody, you know, a real patriot, you know, the one who basically brought the nation, New York and the nation together as America's mayor in the wake of 9/11. And so Giuliani, being trained as a prosecutor, first and foremost, decides to go to Ukraine and basically run an investigation and talking to who he believes at the time are the right people. And this is when we are introduced to such individuals as Andrei Derkash, known later on for the leaked tape, the Derkash tapes, because he organized a few press conferences where he allowed for some of the content of the tape to be explained to the public and what the implications were. But also, I would say, a junior prosecutor, Alexander Kulik, who also was very helpful in getting those things done. Someone known as Alexander Dubinsky, also, who was a former MP at the Rada, journalist and MP, and who is now, interestingly enough, rotting in the Kiev jail. And so Dubinsky is jailed. Kulik is not authorized to leave Ukraine. Shokin is also not authorized to leave Ukraine. And Derkash was on the run. He somewhat disappeared in early 2022. This was, actually reported by, as you mentioned, Simona Maggionte when she interviewed him about 3-4 months ago in Minsk. Mm-hmm. And we found out that no other than Nazis saying that, or to be sure, you know, there are no independent corroborating evidence on that, but that the Secretary of State Blinken visited Kiev in January 2022, so about a month before the start of the special military operation, and basically told Zelensky in no uncertain way that we have a problem, and unless you take care of it, we will take care of it. And at that point, Derkash, you know, having his own informers, knew that it was time to go. And so,
I know you talked about this, Arno. You talked about this on RT International just recently during a second. Let's bring that clip up, actually. This is Arno Davile just a couple of days ago. Let's go ahead and roll that.
Now, there hasn't been a direct link made to the Crocus City Hall terror atrocity, but judging from the allegations that we're hearing, is it more likely than not that the oil and gas company Burisma Holdings was involved in some way in financing that attack?
Well, this is something that the Russian investigative committee is going to have to determine, to be sure. But this is nothing new. I actually have a book coming out tomorrow called Foreign Entanglements, which covers the Burisma-Biden saga. And this goes back to 2014. We know that there were bribes paid to close out some of the case files against Dan Sloshevsky, the CEO of Burisma. And the company became essentially a vehicle to launder taxpayers' money. I would point also to the tapes released by, or made public, should I say, mm-hmm. by Andrei Derkash, the former Ukrainian MP, back in 2020 on this issue, in which he perfectly establishes all the links, whether about Hunter Biden, the NAFTA gas situation with Austin. And now we have an interview that came out recently from Minsk, by Simona Maggionte. She interviewed Derkash, who is now in hiding, fearing for his life. Blinken came in January 2022 in Kiev and basically told the Zelensky regime, you've got to resolve the Derkash situation or else we will do it ourselves.
So there we are, Arno. So, I mean, there's so much evidence now that almost kind of vindicates the accusations made by Andrei Derkash about a slush fund for black ops, assassinations, terrorist attacks, even mentioned Nord Stream in there. This might be tangentially connected to the Nord Stream operation. So we have all of these people. We have Konstantin Kulik, who you mentioned before, who's a prosecutor. You have Andrei Derkash, former MP. You have Viktor Shokin, former prosecutor general. You have Oleksandr Dubinsky, who is working closely with Derkash. All of these people should be testifying in Congress to the Congressional Committee on Biden corruption and Biden activities in Ukraine. I mean, are these not the best witnesses Congress could have? And they can get them if they wanted to. They'd have to provide assurances and maybe give the proper orders to Kiev. But this isn't happening, Arno. The opposite's happening. Are we witnessing a cover-up?
Well, this is actually the heart of the matter as far as those impeachment hearings are concerned. It's just not like an instance of political theater aimed at basically creating a diversion from the real issues in this. Because as you say, if you really wanted to establish the links and what the Democratic Party has been saying as far as there's no direct chain of causality between what you are alleging and the crimes, those four individuals would be able to provide all the goods. Yet, there are no subpoenas being issued. We learned that the FBI, who was relying for 20 years on an informer, the informer himself, somehow, he must have been the person, you know, named in the 1023 form. This guy was himself basically sold down the river now. So there's a lot of pressure at every level to make sure that none of this comes out. Because if it does, it's not just the Ukraine operation that basically is revealed. It's the level of corruption and how dangerous, you know, this profligacy from the Washington establishment has become, with basically a risk of World War III, because with the terrorism phase now entering its full phase, we are dangerously teetering on the brink of precipice here, launching terrorist attack in the heart of a nuclear armed power who understands perfectly the ins and outs of what's going on and who's ultimately behind it. And to be sure, if we go back what former Russian President Medvedev seems to have alluded to in a recent post, is they're going to go after every single one of them. We could have like an arrest warrant issued against some of the principals that, you know, we've mentioned tonight, the Kofor Blacks, the Hunter Biden, the Devin Archer, and to the extent his presidential immunity is removed in November, then President Joe Biden. So this is a whole house of cards that you know could be coming and crashing down, and basically exposing Washington. I mean the swamp, as it were, you know, in ways that would be unprecedented, and that would certainly lead to unprecedented political chaos in the United States.
Well, all we can say is one thing that this book does is it vindicates Rudy Giuliani and all the things that he was saying, the depositions that he took while he was in Ukraine. It vindicates Donald Trump's suspicions, of course, among other things. But it also says that there was no Russian interference in the 2016 election, but there was Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election. I mean, that's pretty clear from this book, Arno. So, I mean, this is why I really encourage people to get a hold of this. It's not a long read. It moves very quickly. And the receipts are there. The footnotes are there. The research notes are included in the book. You can follow up on pretty much every single fact in here. Tremendous job on your part, Arno, to put this together. It's a very complicated story, very complex case. And this is, I think, one of the things, it's so daunting. It's probably, you know, put a lot of people off writing books like this, because you really have to put your nose down and see where the rabbit holes go in this. And you've absolutely done that. I think it's going to provide a great foundational platform for other people to take your research and then add to it, which is, I think, something that you're very keen happens as well as a result of the publication of this book. Foreign Entanglements is the book, ladies and gentlemen. Arno Develle is the author. Ukraine, Biden, and the fractured American political consensus. Arno, we really appreciate it. Just give a shout out to where people can get a hold of this book, and you know, what's do you know what it's retailing for, etc., in the US? Is it available in Europe or any other languages? Go ahead.
For now, it's only available in English. I intend to get a Russian translation done, you know, in the shortest delay. But for the time being, people can find it on, as you mentioned, Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
So I think, yeah, it might be on the shelves in Barnes & Noble, hopefully, in the coming weeks and months. But yeah, definitely, you guys, show your support for Arno on this. Get a hold of this. I think everybody needs to read it, especially if you're participating in the next U.S. general election. I think you need to have a little bit of background here. This is going to help, hopefully, and help inform you know, which way you might be voting. Unfortunately, there are some people, actors, who are part of this story who are still in office, believe it or not. There's a few of them knocking around Capitol Hill. But I think this is instructive. Good, great timing, Arno. Glad that this book is out now. And you've done a tremendous job. And again, thank you for your time. I know it's late in Moscow, so you've really stayed up for us here. I really appreciate it, Arno.
Thank you, Patrick. Always a pleasure.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. That is Arno Develle, author of Foreign Entanglements. And great book, folks. We're going to be going deeper into this. We're also going to make public a couple more interviews and a bit more analysis on this book in the next couple of days and weeks. So look forward to that. Anyway, we're going to take a break here. Top of our news headlines coming up on the other side. Basil Valentine, stay with us. We'll be right back.